Welcome everyone to another episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I am Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Anik Ahmed, a practitioner in the finance sector.
Brilliant. And this is episode three, part three of the launch series, the final part of the launch series. Anik, how are things since I last talked to you?
Nothing too exciting, Deepak. No shiny jewellery.
No shiny jewellery
that I can talk about.
Well, technically, I don't have the shiny jewellery. I'm not wearing the shiny jewellery. But yeah, I suppose I got a little bit of a bit of big news. I got engaged a little while ago, which is pretty big news for me. Nice shiny ring, which is cool. Not for me. For my fiance. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It was weird because I think we always think about that moment when you actually get on your knee and you do the thing. And the one thing I wasn't expecting was to become a blubbery mess. I had it planned out the night before. So I was like, okay, I got things I want to say. I want to say these really nice things, be really suave, and then open the box and then, you know, say the words, you know, will you marry me? Rather than doing that, I got there, got on one knee, said one line, realized, oh no, I'm not going to be able to get through this. Was on the verge of crying, managed to get, will you marry me out? And then opened the box upside down and then went, no, I got it. Here we go. And then, yeah, she said yes. So she said yes. So that was good. But I think I nailed it in terms of the setting. So I took her up.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the famous peak in Edinburgh. It's in the centre of Edinburgh, this mound or hill. I don't know what to call it, but it's a famous, like...
It's steep.
Exactly, it's steep. It's steep. So I took her up there for sunrise, did the deed, and I'm now someone's fiancé. Do you know, this is something I didn't realise. There's two different words for fiancé. So if you're a fiancé, if you're the male fiancé, it's with one E. If you're a female fiance, it's with two E's. I've had to recently learn that. Something, you know.
But there's no difference in the pronunciation.
No, there's no difference in pronunciation, but there's a different spelling, depending on if you're a guy. And I always have to double check when I'm writing. Like, I'm not saying I'm the fiance with an E. Is that a girl or whatever? So it was a huge thing. It's a really huge thing, you know, making that big step in my life. And it's pretty awesome. You obviously knew behind closed doors as I was planning it and figuring it out. You kind of were in on it to a certain degree. You know, it was taking place. So that was a pretty big story for me.
Well, no, it's amazing news.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting. So, yeah, and I suppose the podcast, in terms of the podcast, what have we been up to? It's been a few advancements, a few big things that have happened. So we've now got a third member in the team. I did mention him previously. He was doing the artwork and the logo design, but now he's officially on board. Adam Khan, he's one of my oldest friends, and he's doing the graphic designing. So he designed our logo, like I say. He's doing all the artwork, which we have really loved. I think the artwork has been really cool so far. So he's been pretty I've kind of given him free rein to just go with it. So he's been pretty cool. So he's on board, which is pretty exciting. And in terms of the podcast, so like I said, this is the launch series part three, but from this point onwards, we're going to release an episode every month. And for all you listeners, just be ready the first Wednesday of every month, where we're going to release the episodes going forward. So that's kind of generally the little important stuff that we need to get out of the way. Anik, I think the most important thing, the topic of this episode, what is it? Let me know what the topic is.
Modern slavery, Deepak.
Yeah, pretty interesting topic for sure. But we always say this, but it really is. we always say, but they're always interesting, aren't they?
They are. And the people we bring on are fascinating as well. And I think the person we brought on today is, we really enjoyed the conversation. So
yeah,
and we can't wait to bring it back on if she does come on.
For sure. And I've obviously got a bit of a special relationship with this guest. She was one of the supervisors of my PhD. So it was really nice to have her, to sit her down and talk to her about her research. And so without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome everyone to this interview installment of this
episode of the House of Wisdom podcast. Today's guest is Philippa Webb. She is a professor of public international law at Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London. She came to academia after a career in legal practice at an international law firm, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and the United Nations headquarters. She's worked and studied in Australia, Japan, France, the Netherlands, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Her areas of research interest and expertise are international dispute settlement, state responsibility, human rights, law and the use of force, and all aspects of the law and immunities. Her work on state responsibility for modern slavery, conducted with her colleague Dr. Rosanna Garcindia, has been presented at the United Nations and awarded funding by the British Academy. And perhaps most importantly, she's my boss. Philippa.
Hi, Deepak. Hi, Anik.
Brilliant. So just to kind of set the tone and create a bit of a relaxed and chilled atmosphere and vibe, and for the listeners to kind of get to know the person behind the research, we've got a few light-hearted questions just to get the ball rolling.
Yeah.
But we start off with our age-old question, which is, if you were stuck in the House of Wisdom, so imagine this: the House of Wisdom is a literal thing. We always imagine that it is a literal thing. Who would you want to be there with? So who would be the ideal person you want to be stuck in the House of Wisdom with for, let's say, 2 or 3 months? It could be an intellectual, could be an inspiring figure. Who do you choose?
So there's really only one choice for me, given recent events. And I'm assuming that the House of Wisdom is somehow magical and that it can be someone who's no longer with us. So I would choose Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who sadly passed away recently. And I would have chosen her anyway, because she's just such an inspiring figure, not just to me, but I think to generations of law students, women and men. Her fight for gender equality as a practitioner, as an academic, and of course on the bench, just leaves the most amazing legacy. And at the same time, from everything I've been reading about her, especially with the outpouring of memories recently, she sounds like someone who was also very witty, engaging, and did things with great style. So I think she would be a wonderful companion in the House of Wisdom.
Yeah, I feel like that'd be such an inspiring person. Like you say, also, I think has an element of wit and humor about her. So she's got kind of those two things you'd probably want in someone if you were going to be in the House of Wisdom for a number of months and you'd want to choose someone. So I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be the perfect choice. I was just reading about her and you know, some of her stories is just incredible. I mean, she's had to deal with cancer numerous times, and she continued to work on and power on and play her role in American legal system. She studied at law at Harvard in the 50s and 60s whilst I think her husband was struggling with testicular cancer.
Yeah.
So she was also taking care of her husband and continuing, and a child, and yeah, continued to study law in a male dominated age. Yeah. So it, she was a real fighter, and what she's done for gender equality, absolutely incredible. So yeah, what a person to definitely choose.
And I'd just like to share with your listeners a couple of quotes of hers that I've come across in the recent days, which I think are very inspiring and worth sharing. So someone had actually asked her a few years ago, when your time comes, what would you like to be remembered for? And she said, someone who used whatever talent she had to do her work to the very best of her ability and to help repair tears in her society, to make things a little better through the use of whatever ability she has. So I think that quote just shows the combination of modesty, but also grit and determination that she demonstrated throughout her life. And there was another quote that I really liked, which I think could be relevant to the academics and students among us. When she was giving advice to her clerks who were drafting documents for her in the court, she said, get it right and keep it tight. We could all learn from that.
No, that is a brilliant line, and that's something I'll be using at work shortly, definitely.
Yeah, it seems like, I kind of said earlier, she's got that perfect blend of, and those quotes, I think, encapsulate that really well, but that perfect blend of being someone that's a truly inspiring figure, but then got that added humour. So I think in both those quotes, you can really portray or encapsulate her in really well.
And I think the question that I want to ask is, now that you've got the person that you're going to be stuck with for the next 3 months, how do you design that house of wisdom? What's going to give you inspiration?
Yes. So, I mean, you know, we've all been in lockdown, we've all been working from home. And I think, certainly in my case, what I keep fantasizing about is a proper home office. And my dream home office would be a library with bookshelves up to the ceiling. And, you know, you see in these old movies, you see the bookshelves are so high that they need a sliding ladder to reach the books at the top. That would be my dream, to be working or having a coffee with Justice Ginsburg in that room. I think your house of wisdom should also have a huge garden if we're going to have socially distanced get-togethers. And then, of course, we need a cinema and a pool as well, because, you know, we're stuck at home.
Brilliant. I think every time I've kind of given the explanation, I've only gone as far as books and thought, what else? So I'm glad, like, you've added the garden in, and you've got a cinema, and you've got maybe like a nice coffee section there. So that's I think that's a really good setup for the place.
That was my I explained to Deepak earlier that I wanted a library with a view of space.
Oh,
and
wow.
I thought, what better inspiration, as I'm looking at certain books, looking out into black holes, stars, galaxies. Why not? Maybe it'll be up there in the space station. So
yeah.
And Deepak criticized me for the books. So,
well, I mean, at least you came up with something interesting. I just said I want a squash court. So I've kept my standards quite low and not really thought about inspiration.
Physical health is important too.
That's true. but I feel like my one's a bit more of a man cave than actually like a house of wisdom, somewhere you go to kind of be enlightened. So yeah, I think Anik's got a better.
Deepak was designing his house. It's a slightly different question.
Brilliant. Okay, so I suppose that's kind of the more lighthearted questions out of the way. So in this episode, we're looking at the issue of modern slavery. So the International Labour Organization reported that an estimated 40.3 million people are in slavery on any given day in 2016. It is a massive problem that the international community faces, yet general perceptions of slavery are that it is a thing of the past, or is that an issue that we've overcome? Philippa, your work with Dr. Rosanna Garcendia looks at this issue. And perhaps more importantly, it covers two things. First of all, it brings the conversation back into the mainstream, looking at the fact that, you know, this isn't a thing of the past. This is something that we're still struggling with, still dealing with. But also, and I think this is perhaps where your research really fits in with the mold of the podcast, is that it's actually gone beyond the academic community and it's interacting with the practicing world and giving recommendations. So Philippa, could you just maybe give us a little bit of an insight and a bit of a general description about the research?
Sure. So back to your introduction to me, which was very kind, thank you. You mentioned that I came to academia after a decade in legal practice, both in law firms and international organizations. And I think I've never, you know, quite let go of that practical mindset. So all of my research, including the research on modern slavery, I try to bring that practical mindset too. So for me, it's not enough just to theorize a problem or diagnose a problem, but I feel that my research project is not really complete or satisfying until some real practical recommendations come out of it. So that is something that informs all of my research and certainly has been a feature of this research. So as you said, we thought modern slavery was something that was abolished 100 years ago. You know, in 1926, the International Slavery Convention was adopted. It's now considered to be customary international law and even a jus cogens norm, meaning a super norm that can never be derogated from. But despite its really unassailable status in law, in practice, as you've said, there are millions of people who are enslaved right now in many countries in the world. So what this research sought to do was to come up with some practical recommendations to dealing with this massive problem, but also to find an angle that could make a real contribution, because obviously there's a lot of civil society organizations that are working on this. It's one of the sustainable development goals of the UN that's been adopted by all states to eradicate modern slavery by 2030. So there is attention on this, and there is funding for it in various parts of the world and institutions. So what Rosanna and I wanted to do was to use our academic learning and experience to uncover an area of this where real change could be made. And what we came up with was the state's role in all of this. So when you think about modern slavery, first of all, you think, is slavery even a problem today? But if you accept that it is, you think, well, that's a problem of criminal organizations. It's armed gangs smuggling people around the world in a kind of mafia or other non-state organization. And that is certainly true. Non-state actors play a huge role in modern slavery. But this doesn't let states off the hook. And what Rosanna and I do in our research is we identify five scenarios in which states play a role in modern slavery. And we use concrete examples of states to show this is not purely hypothetical. And we also then follow that up with recommendations targeted to those scenarios to help enhance accountability for the state actors who are committing or facilitating modern slavery.
So for me, what was really interesting was this aspect of making quite clear that although general perceptions are it's a thing of that we've dealt with 100 years ago, that these practices are still taking place, but in a different way, that the face of slavery has almost changed, I would say. And so for me, what I found really interesting was the acquiring of all the evidence. And in terms of like just in a research perspective, how was that? In what way did you acquire all that evidence? You know, how did this research project, what direction did this research project take you into?
Yes, you're right. So we're, you know, Rosanna and I are just two academics who are not able, sadly, to go on fact-finding investigations around the world to gather this data directly. So we had to partner with someone that had that capacity, and that was the United Nations University. Now, I don't know if you've heard of the UN University. It is long established. It's actually headquartered in Tokyo, Japan, and it's a research university. So it doesn't teach undergraduates. It does have some PhD students, but it's mostly a research center. And one of they do research on all kinds of international policy issues, but one of their main streams under their former director, Dr. James Cockayne, was and still is modern slavery. We approached them to partner with them on this research. So it was a great match because they have all the data, they have all the links with civil society, with states reporting, even with, you know, UN bodies gathering information in all of their duty stations around the world. So they had that, but they perhaps didn't have the luxury that academics do of, you know, sitting back and really thinking deeply about this research and producing these kind of long form academic writings on it. So we got funding from the British Academy, and we worked with them, and they fed us the data. And then we tried to fit this into a legal framework based on state responsibility. And I have to say, it was a really fruitful partnership. And as you mentioned also in the introduction, we ended up actually launching our recommendations at UN headquarters in New York.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, Philippa, was about the role of state actors in kind of implementing this legislation, but also making sure that it remains effective. How effective do you think international law has been then in trying to manage modern slavery?
So, on two levels, I think international law has been very effective at setting out what the obligations of states are. I don't think there's really any debate about, the prohibition on slavery and the obligation, the positive obligations on states to prevent slavery, to punish slavery, to legislate against it domestically. That's all been set out in comprehensive treaties. Also, it's backed up by regional treaties such as the Council of Europe Convention. So if we're looking for what the law says, I think it's very well set out by international law. Where international law perhaps is not so effective is in the implementation, and in particular the holding of states accountable for lack of implementation or for poor implementation. It was quite challenging crafting our recommendations to states in this project, because it's unrealistic to say, okay, if you don't comply with these primary treaty obligations, you're going to be hauled before the International Court of Justice. I mean, that's just such a remote possibility. Yeah. As Deepak would know, there's all kinds of jurisdictional challenges to even getting in front of the International Court of Justice. It has to have the consent of both parties, and the scope of that consent may be disputed. The court only hears 3 to 4 cases a year. It takes 3 to 4 years on average to issue its judgments. You know, this is not a mechanism for holding states accountable for really serious and ongoing human rights violations, or it's not the only mechanism that you can rely on. So we had to think creatively about what international law has set up or provided for in terms of accountability. And, you know, often that doesn't involve a courtroom. Often that's using political pressure or more domestic mechanisms to enforce international law. So, for instance, the United States has put an import ban on rubber gloves from one of the biggest factories in the world, which is located in Malaysia, because there is credible evidence of forced labor being used extensively in that factory. So that's a domestic measure, but it's a really powerful signal. And, you know, Malaysia has reacted straight away to that action by the United States. That's not something that international law has, you know, legislated for in a sense, but it is something that domestically can be done in order to enhance compliance with international norms.
And I think for me, that's quite an interesting part of your research in terms of actually putting the onus or the responsibility on states to deal with this, rather than perhaps looking at, you know, what can international law do? Well, actually, international law has created or developed, within international law, we've developed enough legal instruments to hold individuals or states responsible for the violation of slavery or for slavery practices. But I suppose in your paper with Rosanna, you've definitely put responsibility for states to be more ethical about what kind of businesses they interact with.
Yes.
And just generally having a sense of understanding of the repercussions of doing business without really thinking about how these slavery practices are being used to facilitate these sort of organizations or companies.
Yes, and you know, there's so much that depends on the political will of states, which is closely related to how they comply or not with international law, but it's also a completely, you know, separate phenomenon that international law may not be able to do much about. So I said the US has been very responsive on what's been happening in Malaysia. It's also been very responsive on evidence of slavery practices in Mauritania. It, you know, it put sanctions on them as well. But let's look at when you get a powerful state involved. So you've all heard about the Uyghur violations in China, where a million or more people from the Uyghur ethnic group are being detained in re-education camps and forced to work on the cotton industry. 84% of the total cotton produced in China comes from the region where the Uyghurs are being held. And you just think about how much cotton China must produce, you know, for global trade. This is huge. And yet, because China is a member of the Security Council, it's such a powerful economic and political force, there's been statements of condemnation and there's been attempts to, you know, sanction China or do something about the cotton industry on the domestic level, but not yet very effectively. But there's no discussion about holding China accountable for this in terms of international law.
And I came at it from quite a different view, actually, when I was talking to Deepak. I mean, he was telling me a lot about the international law framework, and that's something I was quite new to. But the first thing that I looked at when I saw your paper was, who makes money from this? And I straight away tried to look at some statistics from the, I think it was the International Labour Organization. One of their kind of headline stats was $150 billion a year industry from modern slavery practices.
Yes.
And probably about, I think, a third to two thirds is coming from Asia Pacific and developed economies and the EU. And that was quite interesting when I started going through this investigative trail, that the recipients of modern slavery, a lot of them are sitting in the Western world.
Mm.
And it would be interesting to hear your view on whether you came across that, because a lot of your research obviously focused on where those practices are happening and who is violating those international laws or laws that states must comply with. But did you come across that in your research?
Yes. So the Western world is deeply implicated in many ways. Western states, Canada, the US, the UK, have huge export credit programs where they support their national private companies to invest overseas. This is billions and billions of dollars worth. There's been evidence, extensive evidence, of that export credit being invested in entities that engage in slavery. So there's a big case that's going through the Canadian courts, the Nevsun case, where a Canadian company, Nevsun Mining, has a mine in Eritrea where the Eritrean laborers were there under forced labor conditions. So on the one hand, you've got a Canadian company implicated in that, but also the US provided export credit for that investment also to take place. So there's all kinds of links there. And it's not just the Western world in terms of governments as well. Going back to the Uyghur, massive human violations against the Uyghur people, evidence has shown that the forced labor by the Uyghurs in China is in the supply chains of 83 global brands. So Apple, BMW, Gap, Nike, Samsung, Sony, Volkswagen. You trace down their supply chains and there's evidence of Uyghur forced labor being used. So this is not something that we can say is a problem only in North Korea or only in Eritrea or even only in China. Because as you've said, this, the money and the people and the products are flowing around the world. It's the third largest, you know, international industry, illegal industry behind the flows of drugs and weapons. It's people. So, yeah, it's undeniable that every state has a responsibility to make sure that they are not committing or facilitating modern slavery.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And one of the recommendations that I kind of stuck on was the one around sanctions. And of course, if you're a bigger power economically, it's easier for you to sanction someone without much economic repercussions. But you mentioned, for example, China, who does have geopolitical and economic clout. It's very hard to get into economic battle with them and win. How important is it then to use our non-state actors, like our big companies who have supply chains abroad, and kind of use them to indirectly influence practices in those countries? So in my simplistic vision, if Apple is working in that country, which has a very high modern slavery propensity, you know, to breach modern slavery practices, we tax Apple a certain amount because they operate in that region. And then Apple has incentive to kind of implement good practices in that country and its operations in order to bring down that rating of that country so that it doesn't have this kind of large tax on it from its local country.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really that's got really good potential as a method of changing behavior. So as you've said, you know, even if the UK sanctions China, it's not going to change their minds. But not just that Apple, you know, would be taxed more, but what if there was a consumer boycott of Apple that didn't just force them to you know, reconsider their supply chains, but they actually withdrew from China. I mean, if you're thinking big, that is game changing. But one of the things that's also interesting from a private sector perspective is not just trying to influence these big multinationals that produce some of their products or components there, but the financial sector. And we mentioned, I think, in our research, the Liechtenstein Initiative for a financial sector commission on modern slavery and human trafficking. So this is an initiative, as it sounds, of Liechtenstein as well as Australia and the Netherlands, that is also supported by UN University, where they are working with the financial sector to encourage it to use its leverage to influence business transactions where modern slavery is implicated. So it's not just that China would lose the benefit of having you know, many of its workforce employed by big multinationals, it's that China would have conditions placed on its access to capital if the financial sector took this seriously. And I think that would have a big influence.
So I kind of want to maybe bring it back a little bit. And because for me, one interesting point and interest for me is changing perceptions about slavery. We both talked about the fact that slavery is often considered a thing of the past. And one of the reasons perhaps it is considered a thing of the past is because the practices now are so different to the traditional viewpoint of what slavery was generally considered to be. So maybe could you give us a few examples, which you've done in the paper, of what modern slavery practices are and some examples of this going on?
Yeah. Can I turn the question back to you and Anit for a moment, because it'd just be of interest to me. When you hear the term modern slave, what kind of person springs to mind?
For me, it's forced labour. And the only reason I'm more familiar with it is because I was, prior to this role, I was working in a few banks where when they introduced the Modern Slavery Act, we were looking at the companies that we lend to and work with and seeing their supply chains of where they're using forced labor. So that was my limited view. When I read your paper, you've broadened a lot of those examples to sexual exploitation, domestic workers who have been brought in from abroad and forced to work. In my simplistic view, I was just looking at people using paying people under the wage they should be paid, effectively. Mm-hmm.
I would even take it even more simplified. When I hear slavery, the first thing I really think of is, you know, America in, you know, the pre-1900s. I mean, but I also think generally, I think that's what the perception of slavery is. When they hear slavery, they think of, you know, what the American politics of a bygone era, rather than maybe talking about the more sophisticated, more complex slavery practices that are going on to this day. So I think that's why it's really important to maybe touch on this point and realize, okay, well, actually, slavery has changed massively to what we see in films or books. Because I think generally when we kind of interact with films and books and maybe the entertainment industry, the idea is, oh, slavery is this kind of thing where you had a slave owner who had all these slaves, but
in chains,
absolutely. I think it's really important to then stop, have a look, and say, actually, well, there's a lot of slavery practices going on, but you just wouldn't even consider them to be slavery practices.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point. So according to the Global Slavery Index, the typical slave is female. 71% of people in modern slavery are female. And one in four is a child, 25%. So, you know, the image of the sort of beaten down, usually male person of color in chains is completely unrealistic. So more typical slave may be, you know, a Uyghur woman making components for Apple around the clock in an unsafe working environment. Or it could be a Filipino woman with her passport confiscated working in a, you know, glamorous house in Kensington for a diplomat here in London. Or it could be a child picking crops in South America for no pay or little pay. So, yeah, the face of modern slavery has changed. It's also, it's still, you know, a construction worker working on a stadium in Qatar as well. As we know, that's also the face of modern slavery. But it is diverse. There's a lot of women, three quarters women. There's a lot of children. Slavery is not just working outside in chains. In fact, it's very often not that. It is, as you said, Anik, it's sexual exploitation. It is domestic work hidden behind the front doors of imposing homes. It is also forced marriage, which is recognized as a form of slavery and is very extensive in certain parts of the world. So yes, the face of slavery has very much changed. What hasn't changed is back what was said in 1926 in the convention, which is that the core of the violation of slavery is exercising rights of ownership over a person.
And I think what's quite interesting in terms of looking at slavery is I feel like a lot of states have almost said that they've dealt with it because they've developed legislature in their domestic legal setting that's abolished slavery. But I think it's quite clear when we look at your research, when we look at your paper, that it's not enough. There's definitely still ways through which, you know, state officials have been part of slavery practices, state organs, a whole slew of ways in which slavery practice is still taking place. So I think it kind of goes back to this idea there should be onus on states to deal with it. I think states almost feel like they've done enough and they've washed their hands of the responsibility. Yeah. And like you say, that usually the focus is on these non-state entities. So just, I think it's quite interesting to just maybe discuss that in terms of, I think states perhaps are a little bit, what would the word be? Just a little bit lapsadaisical about the whole matter because they feel like they've dealt with the issue.
Yeah. And, you know, on the other hand, states love to sign up to declarations against modern slavery, and they have happily signed up to the Sustainable Development Goal 8.7 to eradicate modern slavery. Who can disagree with that? But in their mind, they're thinking this is slavery by non-state actors that we need to stamp out. It's not slavery by states themselves. So they're very happy to fight against slavery when it's being done by, you know, organized criminal groups. But when it's being done by their own state officials or an ally's state officials. That becomes politically much more difficult. And just to give you a concrete example of that gap between what we say or what a state says in its laws and what it does in practice, a good example is Mauritania. So Mauritania, if you look at their legislation, it's you know, the model legislation on prohibiting slavery. They were very late to introduce it, but that when they did introduce it, model provisions. However, where it falls down is in enforcement. And there's extensive evidence of slavery being alive and well in Mauritania. And Rosanna and I have, along with another colleague at King's, Mav Ryan, have conducted research specifically on Mauritania. And there's evidence that police officers ignore cases of slavery that are brought to their attention, so they just don't investigate. If they do investigate and then it comes before a prosecutor, prosecutors have tended to delay their action on those cases, and you know, and these are urgent cases where someone is in an enslaved situation, or they have settled the cases informally, given them a plea deal. Judges have also delayed their decisions on these cases, and of the very, very few people convicted for slavery in Mauritania, if you actually look what happens after their conviction, in some of those cases, they're released on bail and they never face the consequences of what they've done. So you've got, you know, model legislation, but actually completely inadequate implementation. And it's very hard for the international community to expose and hold states like this to account. And it's quite ironic that Mauritania has actually been chosen as what's called a SDG Pathfinder state. So the SDGs are the Sustainable Development Goals. And as I've mentioned, one of them is to eradicate modern slavery. Well, Mauritania has been designated a Pathfinder state, meaning that it is a model state that can share best practices on how to eradicate slavery.
And was that appointment political, I imagine?
Yes. I think that's quite obvious.
So the thing, I mean, I'm probably sounding like a broken record a little bit. So I did some work for a client on behalf of, I think, the World Bank or IMF on how could we set up a banking sector in the Republic of Somalia? And how could we make that work? Because a lot of people there were like forced into labour, forced into cheap labour, forced to go abroad and be exploited, and forced to borrow money from kind of shady mm-hmm. money lenders mm-hmm. and get exploited that way. And the conclusion of that piece of work was, yes, we need to kind of think about some of the structures that other countries use and bring that here. But it all came back to the same kind of conclusion that if your rule of law isn't strong, if education isn't there, literacy rates aren't there, if there's not any economic or business or kind of opportunities to make stable income, none of this really works, and the exploitation will keep going, because the conclusion for an individual in those countries is, I can't make money here, or I can't make proper money. I must follow this person who's just said to me, I'm going to give you X amount if you come with me.
Mm.
And unfortunately, they end up in a door, you know, behind an imposing place in some other country.
Mm.
So I suppose I know it's probably wider than the scope of work you set out in your paper, but how much thought do you give to addressing all of these other issues to make your recommendations work?
I think you're absolutely right about the bigger picture, and it's not just for slavery. I think it's true for any kind of human rights violation, that they will thrive more easily in situations where people are open to corruption because of their own desperate personal situations, and also because of blind eye, you know, a lack of a robust judicial and legal system means a blind eye is turned to such corruption. At the same time, when you look at countries of maybe similar levels of development, they don't all suffer from modern slavery in the same way. So, you know, Mauritania is a really disturbing example. But one of the things Rosanna and I would like to do as the next stage of our research is to make it comparative and to look at some more success stories in Africa of states that may have similar development levels to Mauritania, but, you know, for various reasons have not had the same kinds of problems with the resurgence of slavery. And that may be cultural factors, the mix of, you know, whether there's historically been a tradition of chattel slavery, but it can also be, you know, if you have a robust legal system, which doesn't necessarily require a very high level of development, then there's more trust in accountability, there's more deterrence in society. So I don't think we all have to wait for GDP to reach a certain level for real change to take place. And it's interesting about Somalia, which I don't know very well, but my impression is that even you can't even talk about Somalia as a monolith, because some parts of Somalia are indeed, you know, very unstable. There's a lack of governance. But I know that, you know, some states, some companies have had positive dealings with Somaliland, which even though it's, you know, not recognized as an independent state by most countries, has quite an organized system of government. So even, you know, within one state, you can have great variations.
So I want to pick up on the point that you made about having more robust legal systems.
Mm.
And a lot of the examples that you've made, generally Asia, some also examples, I mean, you mentioned Qatar, so also the Middle East. I suppose these are the regions where the human rights courts, the regional human rights system isn't as thorough as perhaps we look at maybe the European Court of Human Rights and the Inter-American Court. Is there a role for human rights systems or regional courts to play in dealing with modern slavery? And perhaps if we saw a perhaps more accelerated growth in these regional systems dealing with human rights issues, that would definitely have a positive impact.
Yes. Which regional systems are you thinking of in particular, Deepak?
So I was looking at ASEAN and the Arab Human Rights Committee, which has definitely had some controversies with certain individuals come to the United Nations. So I think in terms of having more robust systems in place in regions where there are a lot of modern slavery practices going on would definitely have a contributing factor with dealing with them.
I think, you know, layers of accountability are always helpful because of some of the problems I've talked about with the capacity or the jurisdictional reach of the international mechanisms. But I think the systems that you've pointed to are not yet at that stage where they would really be able, certainly from a legal point of view, to make a meaningful difference. So ASEAN is much more of a political body. Even its regional human rights instrument is not a proper treaty. They call it a declaration, an intergovernmental declaration, and it's much shorter than many other human rights conventions. The Arab region also does have, you know, the Arab Charter is more detailed. It does have some committees. It doesn't yet have a court. There's been kind of stops and starts to create a court, but there's not yet a judicial enforcement mechanism. Yeah, I think there's a gap there. And I think if there were more robust regional mechanisms, they could make a big contribution. At the same time, that comes with risk in case that they are designed in such a way not to make such a contribution. So one of the criticisms of the Arab Charter and some of the political bodies in the Arab system is that they have a lot of caveats. So they will, you know, endorse the rights of women, but with the caveat that it has to be in the light of Sharia law. You know, these caveats may really hollow out some of the human rights protections that we would expect to apply. So, you know, there's a question about how effective they may even be if they were operating in practice. But I do want to point out something about the Inter-American system, which you mentioned, because it goes back to your point about Western countries being responsible for this as well. So just at the end of August, the Inter-American Commission issued a really interesting decision on admissibility in a case against the United States. So talking about, you know, taking on the big powers, the American Civil Liberties Union brought a case involving six domestic migrant workers who alleged that they were exploited by diplomats in the United States. And it's, you know, this was scenario three, as you know, in the article that we published. So just showing this happens all around the world. You know, women usually from Southeast Asian countries that come with the promise of a good domestic job in an embassy with working or in a diplomat's residence, working as a cook or a cleaner or a nanny or a babysitter. And then when they arrive, their passports are confiscated. They are not allowed to leave the house. They work, you know, 16 hours a day. And none of the entitlements that were provided for in their contract are actually respected. And they're in a situation of domestic servitude, which is a form of modern slavery. And diplomatic immunity, of course, provides a potential bar to them seeking accountability in the courts. Well, the ACLU has brought this case to the Inter-American Commission on behalf of these six workers and said that there are serious violations of the American Declaration from the failure of the United States to exercise due diligence in preventing, punishing, and providing remedies for the harms caused by these acts against these workers. This is a really groundbreaking case, and happily the Inter-American Commission has granted the first stage, which is to decide that this is admissible and can go to the merits. So that's something to watch closely, and it could be a regional body, a commission, not a court, but making, you know, setting some kind of precedent for even on the international level, but certainly for other jurisdictions to watch.
Yeah, so for me, certainly, I think having certain definite, robust regional systems dealing with human rights violations, and then obviously one of them being modern slavery practices, I think is definitely a key contributing factor to tackle and overcome the modern slavery practices that we're seeing, that we're witnessing in the contemporary world. Kind of one of the last questions before we wrap up, which I think is really important, because we always talk about how academics need to step out of the academic bubble and see how people interact with their work and to see the kind of response of practitioners. Mm-hmm. And you had that experience. You and Rosanna did go to the United Nations, and I kind of just want to hear a little bit about that and what that experience was like. What was the reception? What was the feedback? And maybe some of the outcomes of this experience.
I totally agree with you. We can't just be in our House of Wisdom library thinking up great solutions to world problems and then never actually testing them out. That's why it was really important for us not to present this just in a journal article, which we did do as well, but not just to leave it at that, but to actually go to the UN and speak to, you know, member states and speak to civil society about how, you know, is this practical? Is this realistic? Is this feasible? One thing that was really interesting is that you can't come to these meetings at the UN and present a 30-page academic article. No one is going to read that. So we were advised, and this was very, you know, painful for an academic, to distill our wonderful article down to two sides of an A4 page.
Oh, wow.
Glossy with lots of colours and pictures. So, you know, I mean, that's just playing the game, right? You have to make it something that is easily accessible, that attracts attention, and then hopefully they'll go away and read the more in-depth research. But you've got to first catch their attention, and you're not going to do that with a 30-page densely argued article. So I think that was an interesting tip we received. And then in terms of the presentation and the interaction, there was a lot of interest. It was really interesting, the range of states that came to speak to us. It wasn't just, you know, the sort of states you would think are really active in this area. So obviously the UK was there, the US was there, but it was interesting, Malaysia was there as well, and they had a lot of questions and genuine questions about how some of this could be implemented domestically. So, you know, I think states, especially with the deadline looming for the Sustainable Development Goals, I think states, on the one hand, want to ignore the fact that they may be complicit in this and not just pass it off on non-state actors. But I think, on the other hand, if they think there's some quick wins, if they think there's some really practical things that could be implemented, even by just greater due diligence with who their export credit goes to, that can be positive for them as well. It means they're not going to be caught up in an industry tainted by modern slavery, which is, you know, very bad for their reputation as well. So I think we were pleasantly surprised by the interest in our recommendations, and certainly the feedback we received was, you know, it was a positive aspect of our research that we didn't just conclude saying, well, the only way to resolve this is a case at an international court, and instead the vast majority of our recommendations are things like, you know, look at how your visa system is set up, look how your monitoring and inspection regimes work, due diligence, you know, a lot of internal or bilateral measures that can be taken that don't require, you know, the high profile activity of hauling another state before an international court.
One thing I do remember when you guys came back from the United Nations and from New York, it was really cold when you guys went.
It was the polar vortex. So we managed to get a full house at the UN when it was minus 17 degrees. So that must show they were interested.
Yeah, because I remember you had some Rosanna coming back saying it was so cold. So I definitely, that was one takeaway. And just before wrapping up, I think it's really nice to hear that there is such an optimistic outcome of the research project, of the project itself, in terms of the feedback and the reception you got in the practitioner world was so positive that people were eager and, you know, willing to take note of what you've done. And also on a secondary element, I think this segment is really important perhaps for academics to listen to, in terms of how to actually break down and communicate their research and their expertise in a way that will be more accessible for someone that is not an expert in international law, that is not an expert in international relations. I think this is really an important segment for a lot of academics to listen to and hear, okay, if I want to, you know, break through and have that feedback in the world out beyond academia, I think that there definitely needs to be a more of an accessible approach to the research that is being presented. And so definitely now wrapping up, I kind of want to just kind of end off with that idea that I think general perceptions, and we've definitely discussed this, general perception of slavery is that it is a thing of the past. But if we really look at it, it's just merely changed its face. It's adopted a new face, whether it be human trafficking, diplomatic involvement in domestic servitude or state-backed labor practices. It's changed face. And I think it's really important to realize these are practices going on right now as we speak. Millions of people are being affected by these practices. Billions of dollars are being made by as a result of these practices. And this sort of research is really vital in highlighting why we need to address it right now.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, for the academics listening, that it's really important to be able to present your research, as you say, in this accessible way that gets the attention of people who are very busy with many things and don't necessarily have the specialist background. But the other thing, and I think this is what your podcast is doing, is engaging in conversations with people, you know, including Anik, who comes from a different background. I mean, all the points, Anik, you've been making about your experience from more of a financial perspective are so valuable. And actually, the next stage of this research on modern slavery that Rosanna and I are undertaking is interdisciplinary, because we feel, you know, law is not the only solution here. We need to think more broadly. We need to get, you know, political scientists involved. We need to get historians involved. We need to understand how financial flows work. So the future of impactful academic work, I think, does require engagement with policymakers and also engagement across disciplines.
I'm also very good at putting two pages together and 10 bullets.
You basically described
my job earlier.
Yeah, Anik is definitely the man for being concise. he's definitely lays it down, narrows it down, and is really good at that. So yeah, Professor Philippa Webb, it's been a huge pleasure. Thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you.
Thanks. So that was our interview with Philippa Webb. Deepak, I mean, I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, on a few levels, for sure. In terms of the research she was doing, and for me, one of the really interesting aspects was looking at how to reach out to the practicing world, to the world outside of academia. I think that was really interesting how she said sometimes us academics are too heavy with the details, and then we don't get our information across because it's just kind of not that exciting for. You know, if you're in the United Nations and you're talking to delegates, you're talking to representatives of each country, they want it advertised in a more attractive way. And I thought it was really interesting that she touched on that. And I think it's quite interesting for academics to listen to that and realize, okay, if I really want to get my information, my research across, this might be something that I should take on board and think about when I present my work.
Yeah, I mean, communication, persuasion skills seem to be highly, highly relevant when you're trying to influence a global stage to not just incorporate new legislation, but actually take action. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that I kind of really found interesting during her conversation was how she's not just done the theoretical research. She's not just, you know, gone out and seen what the theory says, but she's actually put tangible recommendations on how kind of state actors as well as non-state actors can take action in order to actually, you know, improve modern slavery practices. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things I did also kind of hang on, and maybe my bias towards finance, was when we started talking a little bit about, you know, where does the money end up, right? Who are the recipients of modern slavery? And whilst, you know, her paper rightly sets out how, you know, in most of the developing countries, that's where most of the practices can be, you know, are very visible. A lot of the people who are receiving and, you know, who are the benefits of modern slavery are sitting in the developed worlds. Mm-hmm. And I found that quite, you know, that's stark, right? That's a real kind of true picture of the developed world, right? That we certainly have to take on board whenever we look at these kind of things.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because it for us as in the Western world, in the developed world, it puts responsibility on us. It makes us realize, actually, we're the people that are facilitating this. We're creating a demand for this, and we're responsible. I think there's a bit of that, the idea of there's a bit of blood on our hands. There's a bit of responsibility, a bit of blame that should be placed on us because. Yeah. You know, because of our the way we are as a society, that, you know, the demands of a modern day society, that's forcing these kind of practices to take place. That then, you know, produce and products and goods can be developed, manufactured to fulfill our appetite. And I think that's really important. I'm really glad that you definitely picked out on that and talked about the fact that we're so responsible for these practices. Often we just look at the face value. These countries in Asia, in Africa, in Middle East, they're the ones practicing these. But why? Why is it that these things are happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked about, I mean, if you just look at it from a monetary perspective, I think it was $150 billion Yeah, regenerated from modern slavery practices. So it's a business, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of components to that, where there's drug trafficking, prostitution, and a number of other things that come under the banner of modern slavery. I mean, it's weird, because since we had that interview, there were a lot of things that came up in the news that made us think, right?
Yeah.
And there was that one, I think that Panorama show that came out recently around kind of what financial institutions had been doing in respect of money laundering. Mm. And so many of them had been shown up as facilitating transactions that do relate to things like terrorist financing, drug trafficking, all things that have the modern slavery kind of web around it as well. And, you know, all of those big banks are based in London.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whilst we are, of course, are massive advocates of trying to reduce these practices across the world, you know, we have non-state actors who are, you know, indirectly facilitating those practices.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of point I was trying to get across with Philippa as well, that, you know, of course, there's a legal aspect you have to look at this as, but also there's the incentives that you need to try to create with non-state actors to change their supply chains, not just in our country, but of course in the countries they operate in, and force those state actors to change.
Yeah.
And that kind of episode or this event kind of brought that bit to life.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend any listeners to watch that and maybe even go further and read some of the detail on the BBC's website.
Yeah, for sure. And I think because it's such a big money maker in terms of, like you say, I mean, how much is $150 billion?
$150 billion, yeah.
Dollars is made from modern slavery practices.
And that's what we kind of know of.
It's very difficult for states to then say, oh, you know, we're not aware of this, we can't do anything. I think states cannot turn a blind eye to it when it's making so much money.
Yeah, definitely.
There's definitely a responsibility that needs to be placed on states to deal with it, to take on that responsibility and to try to pressure some sort of practices to come to an end. There's one last thing I kind of want to talk about in terms of just Philippa herself. I thought it was actually really interesting that the person that she said that she'd want to spend the time stuck in the House of Wisdom be Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I do feel like she's got certain aspects of that herself, Philippa, in terms of like just the way she's tackling these big things. You hear about her when you read about her bio and things that she's done and taking on this big theme, modern slavery. I personally think she's got elements of Ruth Bader Ginsburg within herself. And you know, on a personal level, she's helped me out majorly with my PhD, and so I've seen definitely close contact the kind of academic she is, and I definitely think she's one of these inspiring, incredible figures within the academic community.
I mean, I feel like you have to say that because she's your boss.
But no,
on a serious note, I mean, I was inspired reading that interview. She does some impressive work. So, I mean, it'll be great to bring her back on.
She's definitely she's a big trailblazer for sure. And I think, this is the best time to wrap up this episode. It's been a pleasure once again. Where do the listeners need to check things out? Do you remember the places they need to check things out, Anik?
We're on all the major platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google, and a bunch more. You can see all of that on our website.
Yeah.
So, thanks for tuning in, and see you next time.